Welcome to Leading Lines, a podcast from Vanderbilt University. I'm your host, Derek Brough, the director of the Vanderbilt Center for Teaching. In this podcast, we explore creative, intentional, and effective uses of technology to enhance student learning, uses that we hope point the way to the future of educational technology in college and university settings. In this episode, we have another interview from John Sloop, Vanderbilt's Associate Provost for Digital Learning. Here on the podcast, John has been exploring how colleges and universities understand and teach digital literacies. He continues that theme here with an interview with Casey Boyle, Assistant Professor of Rhetoric and Writing and Director of the Digital Writing and Research Lab at the University of Texas at Austin. John talks with Casey about the work of the Digital Writing and Research Lab, how it is helping students and faculty both produce and think critically about digital and multimodal texts. Casey also talks about his own teaching, particularly his work teaching students to, as he says, write sound. He's doing some really cool things in his rhetoric courses. John starts by asking Casey to talk about the history and mission of the Digital Writing and Research Lab.
I'm here in Dallas at the National Communication Association's annual convention. Casey Boyle is here with me. Casey Boyle is assistant professor in the Department of Rhetoric and Writing at the University of Texas in Austin, where he researches and teaches digital rhetoric, composition theory, and rhetorical history. His work has appeared or will appear in Kairos, Philosophy and Rhetoric, Computers and Composition, Technical Communication Quarterly, College English, as well as the essay collections Rhetoric and the Digital Humanities and Thinking It with Bruno Latour in Rhetoric and Composition. He's managing editor of Enculturation, a journal of rhetoric, writing, and culture. He was managing editor of Enculturation, a journal of rhetoric, writing, and culture, as well as co-editor. You still are co-editor?
Of
Intermezzo. With Scott Barnett.
Oh, yeah. That was an essay collection, yes.
With an essay collection, Rhetoric Through Everyday Things. That's pretty recent.
It came out last year.
Okay.
And paperback
came out this year.
That's
right. Right now, KC is completing its first book. I think this is in production. Is that correct?
It'll be out next September.
It'll be out next September. Rhetoric as a Post-Human Practice. It explores the role of practice and ethics in digital rhetoric. Professor Boyle is also currently, and one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to him today, he's currently director of the Digital Writing and Research Lab at the University of Texas, Austin. As far as I know, it's one of the longest running one of these labs in the nation.
30 years.
So why don't we just start with you telling us a little bit about the mission of the lab, and then tell us a little bit about the history, too. I know that it's produced all types of things over time, so talk a little bit about what the mission is, what it has been, how it's changed.
Yeah, well, it's the Digital Writing and Research Lab at the University of Texas. It's a unit of the Department of Rhetoric and Writing. Also at University of Texas. Its primary mission is to facilitate undergraduate pedagogy and instruction in digital research, digital writing. We have a number of grad student staffers who research projects related to digital writing and digital rhetoric. So that's our primary mission. It's been about 30 years that it's been. We just celebrated our 30 year last year, and its initial sort of starts happened because, and this is one of those myth based histories. Mm-hmm. It's true, but it's one of the histories that come out all the time. Basically, it started because two grad students or a number of grad students drilled holes in walls to connect to computer classrooms, and so it was one of the first networked computer classrooms in the nation, at least in the humanities. And since then, right after the grad students did that, it was in a basement of a building, so that kind of spaces that no one really ever wants, and so these grad students kind of made it their own. One of the professors there, Dr. Jerome Bump, who's actually still on staff in the English department, he got a grant that funded all the brand new computers. And it was later, and it's gone through a couple different names. Computer Writing Lab was one of the first names, but it was a space where our first director, John Slayton, who was kind of at the forefront in the late 90s, at the forefront of thinking about making web text accessible. Prior to that, we thought about just putting web text online, and we didn't really think about how people used web text, but he was one of the first to think through that And so the lab has a history in accessible technologies, teaching accessible technologies, and writing and researching with back then, you know, computers. Now the lab is obviously much more diverse. We do basically a range of different digital projects. We have podcasts, we have online journals that we've done. Students do mapping as a writing exercise. We have a robust series right now of critical gaming events where we open up the doors for undergraduates to come in and learn about critical studies of video games, and they get to play with the video games and discuss that. So we've got a range of different activities and events that we put on and host.
So when I look at the name of the lab, and I'm always sort of interested in these, you talked about some of the change with Digital Writing and Research Lab. Does the university have a separate writing studio, a traditional writing studio, and do you guys, if so, do you work together, or are they seen as very different missions?
Yeah, we do have, and I think what you're referring to is like a writing lab.
Mm-hmm.
Or writing center, I think they're called mostly. We do have another one, and that's also another unit within the Department of Rhetoric and Writing at Texas. And we do not have. Obviously, we're all in the same department, and we communicate between the two between the two missions. But our in the DWRL, our focus is on pedagogy, research. And so in the actual writing center, they focus in on more traditional aspects of writing. They don't do as much multimodal instruction or exercises. They focus in on the written language rather than media. I can imagine at some point in the future us being a lot more coordinated and connected as more and more students are, using digital technologies as a form of writing, as it will become traditional.
So that that's one of the things I was one of the aspects of that relationship I wanted to hear you talk about, and it's because I've been thinking about it a lot lately, and thinking about how digital literacies should be taught in a curriculum at Vanderbilt, where I am, or elsewhere. It seems to me we're moving down a path where. And there's always going to be a space for traditional writing, don't get me wrong, but more and more often I'm seeing in the courses at Vanderbilt, at my institution, but I know elsewhere as well, that faculty are providing students with either the opportunity or with assignments that are either collapsing the difference between writing and multimodal approaches, or doing both of them in the class at the same time. And that's where I'm wondering if that relationship is going to have to come together, or...
Yeah, I think so. I mean, one of the things, and this is where traditional writing instruction and now media instruction is, I think you're going to start seeing a bigger convergence of this. Because there's a big difference in a traditional writing class, let's say, between requiring writing and teaching writing. And I think you're starting to see, and so for the last 20, 30, 40 years, composition studies, for instance, has really advocated for this point. Right? There's a difference between teaching writing and just requiring it.
Right.
And I think we're on the other end for media production. So what you have is a bunch of professors who will, and instructors who will assign, let's say, their students how to do a podcast, right? And they'll kind of offload that instruction of how to actually do it elsewhere. That's exactly how writing used to be, in the 60s and 70s.
Right.
So you would require it in a literature class, let's say, but you wouldn't necessarily teach the steps of it or the process of writing and all of that. So at some point, I think that there will be a sort of correction or alignment where we'll start thinking more seriously about teaching digital media rather than just allowing those assignments to take place.
Yeah, I want to take that one step further.
Yeah.
My own experience, so... Integrating podcasting into my classes, I've tried to, learn some of that on Take It Myself, etc. The piece that's missing for me, and I didn't realize this until the end of last semester, is actually assessment.
Yeah.
I was pretty good at teaching the students how to build a basic podcast, how to work with that. But honestly, I didn't know how to evaluate it once they turned them in. Do you work on those sorts of issues?
Yeah, so this is one of the things where you can tell it's a student production, and a lot of times we see the lights of a, like, let's say, you know, an edited a podcast or something, and our quality meter goes way down. We're happy they did it, and it sounds good, and it looks good, and, you know, if it's a video or something. The quality is definitely not there. I mean, you know, I don't teach in a sort of RTF program where I'm teaching them industry standards, right? Mm-hmm. But one thing I do, I'll give you an example. In my writing with sound class, it's focused on one medium, sound, and recording sound, editing sound, producing it, mixing it. For the most part, my classes have, say, 23 students, you know. At any given semester, I'm teaching it this semester, there's about 20 students who come in who have never done this before. They come in never doing this before, so the first couple of assignments, the first couple of projects they do, they're just not that good. There's sort of what I heard Glass calls the gap between, like, what they can see and what they like and their taste of what they can, you know, recognize as being good and their ability to actually produce that. And so there's a gap between those two things. You can see that they're trying to do this sort of thing, but they're just not quite reaching it. And so what I do in that class is I give them real grades. If it's a bad quality thing, I'll give them a C or an F on this. I don't ask them to rewrite that thing. Usually, at least in the Writing with Sound class, the next project they turn in, if they have improved on those particular techniques or skills from the last one, like, let's say the voice over was really bad, badly recorded, just really noisy. Let's say it was the levels were all off. Let's say it wasn't mixed and normalized very well. If they can improve on those things, I'm not gonna hold against them the fact that they learned in their earlier assignments. So what happens is whatever grade they get on that second assignment, I just automatically give it back to that first assignment too. So if they get an F on that first assignment, which a lot of them do, and I explain this really well, if they get an F on that first assignment, it's a way for me to show, like, the quality of where this is. But the next assignment they get a B, then I give them a B for that first assignment too. And so, I mean, eventually the students actually come out and they work really hard and they develop these skills that they never had before. And they never, you know, they just never worked with before. And I don't hold against them the fact that they actually learned how to do it.
So that's sort of, that's going to be something for me to learn from, because I do find myself just impressed that they actually did it, right?
Yeah.
And I know that's not enough. That's, as a first step, that's certainly the way I'm looking at it. While we're talking about sound, one of the things that I've seen or discovered is that the students have a tendency to, and I guess they do this in most forms of expression, but some of the most successful sounding podcasts are really aping something that or replicating something they've enjoyed. So if they liked Serial, they'll make something that sounds very much like that. Do you discover that a lot?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is why I've been teaching this class now for 4 years, and this is my fifth or sixth time to teach it. And it gets better every semester I teach it, because I get better and better examples to show them. And so the whole class is me inundating them with examples.
Right.
And it's really important that you show them great examples to model. This is the basic of rhetorical training, right?
Right.
Is imitation.
And you're talking about models from other students or models
from other students. So I build those up, right? But also models from other podcasts. And so one of the assignments they have to do for this, like, let's say they're writing with sound class, is that they have to listen to one podcast for a number of weeks, and then they do a sort of a genre analysis of that particular podcast, but also podcasting in general. But they've chosen this podcast to listen to, and so they've got this, like, really deep connection to one particular podcast. And they do, you know, imitate those moves. And this is why I always make sure that, like, I approve which podcasts they're going to select this, right? Because if it's just like this, I'm not sure how you are going to produce this or mix this, if it's going to be sonically rich or not. But if it's just two people talking, I want them to have a slightly more sonically rich podcast to listen to, something like a Serial or a 99% Invisible or one of those things.
Yes. I'm switching gears a little bit, but not too far. So one of the – I think a lot about how to encourage – digital literacies across the curriculum at Vanderbilt. And I've come to this sense that what I have to do, part of my job should be to make everything a faculty might want to try seamless or as friction-free as possible. And my sense really is that that faculty are not only willing but very open to trying out new ideas, trying out new assignments in every discipline. STEM disciplines are interested, rethinking poster sessions, or everyone's interested in doing these things. But if you give the person, if you make it hard to do that, then they'll just continue doing what they've done before, right?
Right.
So, in fact, you came up a couple of years ago when I was first thinking about myself learning how to podcast or do that in classrooms. I was trying to think of what resources were available to me, and I was stumped.
Yeah.
So I thought what I would do, and normally in this case, is I would call somebody I know, like you. And that's not a good enough resource for a university to have. So I've been trying to make sure the resources are available. When I was looking at your website, you have this section on there of lesson plans. Yeah. Is that sort of what that is that helping with that in certain ways? Is that providing models for
faculty? I think so. I mean, if you look at the, like, let's say the Writing with Sound course, that course has been copied like 6 or 7 times. And people, I know this because people tell me, hey, I'm stealing your syllabus and I'm going to teach it. And they ask for the assignments and they ask for the lesson plans for that sort of thing. And so I'm sharing that at my, you know, colleagues at other universities. I share that material with them. I kind of consider syllabi and assignments as like just open source. These are things that we create and they can go off in the world and do their own thing. But in response to the idea of the friction-free stuff, there's a balance, I think, that you have to do there. I think if you do, is it friction-free all the time, then you're almost encouraging, and because with my students, for instance, I don't want it to be friction-free. I want it to have a little bit of friction in there. They need to have some kind of something that they can get traction to where every once in a while something is like disrupted in a slight way. They have to think about, oh, wait, this doesn't work. Right.
Yeah.
And so how do I readjust? How do I do this? And I want to like engineer those kinds of frictionful moments some here and there.
With
students, but also because like, so for instance, our lab is one of our major aims is to encourage and to facilitate digital pedagogy.
Right.
And so what a lot of our staffers do is they'll do workshops for instructors. So like the thing that you're asking, like if you were at Texas,
right.
You could fill out a form, and one of our staffers would come and do a workshop for your class on how to edit an Audacity file,
right,
let's
right.
say. And they'll package this and they'll do that. If it's so seamless for some folks, it's you know that's necessary. I mean, you want to encourage mm-hmm. the students to engage digital literacies, but at the same time, if an instructor wants to truly learn this and to incorporate this as part of it, at a certain point they have to wrestle with. The tech. They have to wrestle with the problems that come up because they do. They come up all the time and being okay with changing plans and having to figure something out. That's kind of the most important thing about digital pedagogy, I think.
Yeah. I do want that with the faculty after they've made the first jump.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Right, right.
Yeah, the first one's free, but after that it's,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, yeah. I know from following you on social media that you guys have a 3D printer, a quality one, right?
Yes.
So what are you planning on doing with that?
So last semester I taught a course called Accessible Rhetorics, and it was a graduate course, and it was dealing with the problem of accessibility, not the problem, but really the possibility of accessibility in digital technology, mostly in communication media, but also other kinds of technologies. And one of the assignments that we did in that class was to work with some physical computing devices like Arduinos or Raspberry Pis to kind of create and speculate about a sort of, I don't want to say fake, but, you know, creating ideas for creating an accessible technology. One of the things that we did in that class, we created these things, but if you've ever seen one of those circuit boards, the breadboards, they got wires everywhere and stuff like that. And one of the great things about 3D printers is that you can print a casing for that, right?
Yeah.
And so the next time I teach that class, I'm going to have the entire class is going to be working around developing and speculating about physical computing devices to respond to accessibility needs. And we'll be using the 3D printer to print casings and stuff like that. The other things we were looking to do with it is one of the projects we're really excited about is thinking through, you're familiar with infographics, right?
Yep.
We're thinking through what does an infographic look like if it's 3D? What does it look like? What kinds of rhetoric can happen? What kinds of persuasion can happen if you develop a chart that is instead of a two-dimensional thing on a graphic, a visual graphic? What happens if you create an object out of that? What kinds of data can you expose people to and relate to people through an actual object rather than a visual print-based sort of document?
Is this being done a lot by graduate students, by undergraduates, or?
Yeah, I mean, all of our staff are grad students, and the lab provides them a space to research these technologies to later use in undergraduate courses and workshops. So right now it's all graduate students, but over the next couple of years, what we're really planning on doing is opening up more and more events for undergraduates to come in outside of their regular classes to engage these kinds of things and discussions. I said earlier, one of the things we just started this year is an event called Game On. And it's we do it on Friday afternoons. Every couple of weeks we do one. We do basically 2 months. And one of our graduate student staffers creates a 3-minute kind of critical, short critical video about a particular kind of game. So last week we did one on what's called platform video games. These are the video games where they had set like a Donkey Kong as a platform mm-hmm. video game. And so we set up one of our studio spaces with 5 different game systems. We bought some snacks and some, soda and stuff, and students and it's geared towards undergraduates. So they come in, they listen, they watch the video, and then they just play the games. And we walk around, we talk to them about critical engagements with these video games and how to think about video games as a sort of rhetorical device, but also a sort of cultural artifact that we can critically engage. So that's one of the events we're doing that's geared solely to undergraduates. We're thinking about a couple other ones. One is an event that we're still planning. It's called real-time rhetoric. And the idea of what we're doing is we're going to have, let's say the State of the Union's going on. We're going to have students come in to the studio space, and we'll together collaboratively sort of annotate the event, the media event of that particular political development. And so, if it's a State of the Union address, some students will monitor social media, see what's trending. They'll look at Facebook, they'll look at websites, and basically do a sort of real-time critical analysis of how a political event is unfolding. So that's another event we're looking to launch in the spring.
If you did that on an ongoing basis, is this something you would make available as through your news and public affairs office for? Because it seems like it could be great outreach.
Yeah, that's one thing. Well, these are new events, and so we mm-hmm. want to kick them off. We want to give them a little bit of we want to go through them a couple times before we talk to outreach,
sure.
Right?
Yeah.
We are talking to outreach. In fact, next when I go back. To Austin and after Thanksgiving break, actually, me and the chair of the department are sitting with our liberal arts media outreach person, mm-hmm. and they're going to do a story about the lab, and we'll talk a lot of what we're doing right now.
Oh, that's
so
great.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
Great. I only want to ask you a couple more questions.
Yeah.
First off, I want to give you the opportunity to talk a little bit about your book.
Oh, my book.
Tell me a little bit about what, when you're writing something like this, it's not just for professional purposes, for tenure, et cetera. I mean, I know you're hoping to change some conversations. So
yeah.
What is it you're attempting to do?
Well, the book is called Rhetoric as Posthuman Practice. And this is a project I've been working on for a number of years. The word posthuman usually scares people off. They think of like the cyborg or these really bad movies of people uploading their consciousness to some machine and living forever or something. And that's not what the idea of the posthuman is. The idea of the posthuman is to reconfigure what it means to be human in an environment in which we acknowledge all the sort of mediated relationships we have. So if we look back at what humanism has meant and become in the West, It's based around literary practices, more or less. It's based around the letter to a friend. It's based around the philosophical novel or the philosophical treatise, right? It's based around this idea of the of a rational, mostly in the West anyways, mostly a rational European male who can clearly articulate some experience of being, right? And clearly and cogently and persuasively articulating this. This is kind of what bases around what the human means. If you look back at, let's say, Leonardo da Vinci and the sort of the Vitruvian man, the sort of ideal. It's a European male who's like perfectly fit, perfectly balanced. But what doesn't fit in the Vitruvian man diagram, which is like that sort of epicenter for what humanism is the, you know, is the non-European fit male, right? And so that's always the base of what humanism is and does. And so what posthumanism does, it kind of emerged around, and this is a kind of a backstory for the book itself, but it emerged around critical feminism and critical feminist materialism, thinking through how technologies mediate what it means to be human. So the book itself is thinking about rhetoric as always kind of that kind of posthuman practice. You know, since its earliest inceptions, the earliest texts, we have to think about Plato, rhetoric was always, and rhetoricians and sophists, they were always framed as being somewhat inhuman. They weren't the ideal philosopher. They weren't the ideal king. They were someone to be maligned, and they were someone who paid too much attention to how things were mediated, right? And so what I'm doing with the book is thinking about how media and literacy practices help determine and kind of and help it can reorganize what we think of as the boundaries of what humans are and do through, I don't know, media practices. So what I do with the book is I look at three different moments in rhetorical history, and really kind of go back and think about these moments, and these moments are the emergence of certain practices in rhetorical training. Disologue, which is like sort of the argument for and against, topoi, which is like a sort of notebook practice, and copia, which is a sort of an exercise, a writing technique where people would, you know, copy and repeatedly write different sentences, but this having the same sense. And one thing I've found is that each of those moments came out of a certain kind of media emergence. So disologue, for instance, comes out of a tradition of chirographic writing, where people wrote, they didn't have that much writing materials around. So, you know, it was, you know, double-sided, basically, more or less. And so that's what you had. When topoi rises and intensifies, it's notebook practices. And when copia comes around, it's, you know, kind of in response to like print-based writing, the repetitions of things, right? And so if we think about those moments as not just like, oh, these are just new techniques that people came up with, but as like responses to certain media emergences, then we start rethinking like what the human is and does, because that's what it is. It's working within those media ecologies.
Yeah, I was about to say, this is sort of a really a practice-based way of thinking about media ecology. That's I'll look forward to reading it.
Yeah.
This podcast is focusing on educational technologies, digital learning. What we're really interested in, what is your favorite non-digital educational technology?
Non-digital. This one's a tough one, but I think if I had to answer, but I think my favorite non-digital would be the highlighter. Just a simple highlighter. To be able to read a text and recreate that text by engaging with it and reading it and highlighting certain passages, because once you do that, it's a way that you don't deface the book that you're reading in a way that you can't read it anymore, but you're picking out and highlighting certain things that matter to you or don't matter to you, or maybe you highlight too much or whatever, right? But I always like seeing a really well highlighted book.
So do you also, I love this answer, but do you also use highlighting tools digitally?
Yes, I do. The way I pretty much only ever read now with PDFs.
Right.
And so most of the books I read are PDFs. So the PDF reader I use, it allows me to highlight certain passages. And the way I've done this is I'll highlight certain passages and I'll make comments and annotate in there. But the actual PDF reader I use allows me to export everything I've highlighted, and it'll export it into a plain text file And so if I've highlighted a passage, I can export that PDF or that text file into an email and then just copy and paste that into a document I'm writing, right?
Oh, that's great.
And so even when I'm reading things, I'm writing because I can just use that text and build up from there when I'm writing a draft.
All right, Casey, I want to thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me. It's been fun.
That was Casey Boyle, Assistant Professor of Rhetoric and Writing, and Director of the Digital Writing and Research Lab at the University of Texas at Austin. In the show notes, you'll find links to Casey's work and the Digital Writing and Research Lab. I'll also add a link to the detailed syllabus for Casey's course, Writing with Sound. I've been exploring ways to teach with podcasts, both in my own courses and with other faculty here at Vanderbilt, and I found Casey's syllabus really fascinating. Any syllabus with episodes of 99% Invisible, one of my favorite podcasts, on it is pretty cool. Bonus points for an assignment called Sonic Remediation. For more on teaching with podcasts, see episode 27 of Leading Lines for our interview with Vanderbilt's Gilbert Gonzalez. And stay tuned in 2018 for audio from a panel on teaching with podcasts that we hosted here at Vanderbilt this fall, featuring, among others, John Sloop, who interviewed Casey Boyle in this episode. You can find past episodes of Leading Lines on our website, leadinglinespod.com. And if you have thoughts on this episode, we'd love to hear them. You can connect with us on Twitter, where our handle is @LeadingLinesPod, or email us a voice memo to leadinglinespod@vanderbilt.edu. We'd love to hear from you. Leading Lines is produced by the Center for Teaching, the Vanderbilt Institute for Digital Learning, the Office of Scholarly Communications, and the Associate Provost for Digital Learning. This episode was edited by Rhett McDaniel. Look for new episodes the first and third Monday of each month. In January, we'll have a couple of episodes on active learning spaces and the use of technology like laptops in the classroom. I'm looking forward to those too. I'm your host, Derek Bruff. Thanks for listening.